In this episode of the Captain Paul Watson Foundation podcast, we will be tackling the subject of shrimp aquaculture. I want to say from the beginning that the Captain Paul Watson Foundation does not support the aquaculture of shrimp. Shrimp are sentient beings that should be left to live their lives in the ocean. Today, I will be interviewing Joshua Farinella. Joshua worked for the Choice Canning Company in India, and he moved there to manage one of their shrimp processing plants. While he was doing that, Joshua uncovered a number of things that disturbed him to the point where he became a whistleblower. He collected information and documents that prove that the company is hiding how shrimps are actually produced. In the course of my conversation with Joshua, we will highlight some of his concerns with food safety, human rights, and environmental issues. Joshua's story is covered extensively by the Outlaw Ocean Project. While most of our listeners are vegan, I do believe that it is important for us to learn about the shrimp industry as a whole. It is a huge industry. The Shrimp Welfare Project estimates that 400 billion shrimp are farmed each year globally. That's five times the total number of farmed land animals. The industry can also be quite cruel. One practice within the shrimp industry is called eyestalk ablation, which involves the removal of a female shrimp's eyestalk in order to increase egg production and force them to spawn. While this episode of the podcast will focus on Joshua's story and his courageous effort to get the truth out, this has inspired me to want to do a future episode that focuses on shrimp aquaculture, but from the shrimp's perspective. So I look forward to doing that in the near future. During our conversation, it is important to note that the shrimp that are being farmed are the Pacific white shrimp and the black tiger shrimp. Welcome to the Captain Paul Watson Foundation podcast. I am your host, Charlie, and I'm joined today with Joshua Farinella. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Joshua, we have you on this podcast to discuss a very serious topic. You were the general manager for Choice Canning at one of their shrimp plants in India. What prompted you to join Choice Canning and furthermore to move to India?
So I was employed by Choice Canning, 10 years ago in their Pennsylvania factory. 2020, I left Choice Canning and took another position. I was with that company for about 3 years, and then Choice Canning, kind of recruited me back with this opportunity at a new facility, a new factory in India. Beautiful facility, state of the art, everything. And that's what, kind of got me back in the door with them.
Right. And so you've been in this industry for a long time. I guess what prompted you to take that first job with Choice Canning back in Pennsylvania?
It was, it's a small town. Opportunities are kind of limited. I did a little bit of research and I saw, they had a good reputation. They were manufacturing, a good product. So that was it. It seemed like a good company to go work for.
Right. So for our listeners that don't know, you arrive to India and you're there at a shrimp processing plant. Can you describe what it's like to grow shrimp and how that process works?
Yeah. So, basically, think of your goldfish tank that you might have at home, except make it thousands of times bigger and full of shrimp. Those shrimp will be harvested out of there. They'll be transported to the factory whole. And once they arrive at the factory, then they'll go through, the whole production process. They'll be beheaded, peeled, cooked, or frozen, packed up and shipped to the US.
So How specifically do the shrimp die? So they're grown in these ponds, and are they simply taken out with a net and left to suffocate being out of water, or how is there a distinct way that they kill the shrimp? How does that work?
They're pretty much dredged right out of these ponds, and they're iced down, and
okay,
that's all she wrote for the shrimp.
Right. So inside of this plant, which is in India, I guess, can you describe the area in India? I believe it's Amalapuram. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Amalapuram.
Amalapuram.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's that area like?
It's a very rural area. Pretty much your biggest industries there are going to be agriculture or aquaculture. Yeah. So you've got, rice paddies or shrimp farms.
Okay. And when you first got to this plant, can you describe the plant to us? What does it look like? How big is it?
It's massive facility, massive compound. It has your production area buildings. Then it has your dormitory and kitchen areas for all the migrant workers who are there. Also has a large water treatment plant.
And with these dormitories, does that take up a bulk of the area, or is the bulk of the area the actual processing?
The majority of the area is the actual processing building. Dormitory areas, they're pretty large, but again, the majority of the space is occupied by the production.
So I read, in kind of researching this before we started talking, that the consumption of shrimp has gone up significantly, in the past 10 years or so. And I read here that about $5 billion worth of shrimp are exported by India globally, and that about 1 in 3 shrimps are consumed, or 1 in 3 shrimps that are consumed by Americans come from India. So it's not just Choice Canning that's operating there, obviously. There's lots of other companies doing this, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Many shrimp companies over there.
So, and then not just that, but it sounds like for the Choice Canning component, they were responsible for shipping about $80 million worth of shrimp from their facilities over in India to the U.S. So was there a lot of pressure, I guess, to constantly meet quotas? Were there quotas for how many shrimp needed to be processed in a month or a day or whatever?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of pressure to get the product shipped. One thing that Choice Canning does differently than most other packers over there is everything that Choice produces has already been purchased by the customer. So it's already bought and paid for. Now it's a matter of meeting that deadline to get them the product that they've already paid for.
Wow. So tremendous pressure then if it's already been paid for, I imagine.
Yeah. Most companies will, most packers over there will already purchase the raw materials, and they'll pack it and then try to, market it to a customer over here, where, with Choice, it's the opposite. Everything's already bought and paid for.
So when you got to India and you started working there, what was the initial feelings that you had? Did you feel like you were walking into a well-run business, or did you have concerns right off the bat?
So when I first got there, at least from previous experience with Choice, I did think I'd be walking into a very well-run business. And then as you start to take over the facility, you realize it might have a couple of issues.
Right. So I guess let's dig into what some of those issues were. Let's start with food safety. What were some of the food safety concerns that you saw?
So in the actual factory itself, There really weren't too many food safety concerns. The food safety concerns that I had were from these external, you know, peeling sheds that were being used in the, you know, in the factory. That's audited regularly by, you know, customers and various other, you know, audit certifications that you need to have, you know, to be able to sell to these customers. Whereas these peeling sheds, they're off book, they're unregulated, they're not audited. They're just there so you can get product in, get product out, and nobody asks any questions about it.
Right. Okay. So they're completely off the radar. If an auditor shows up, they have no idea that, you know, these shrimps are being processed a few miles away from the plant.
Correct. Correct. And, you know, where in the plant, like the actual factory, everything is as it's supposed to be. Everything's clean. The, you know, the hygiene standards are always maintained. And then you get to these sheds and they're just open air. They're, the workers are, you know, peeling in their street clothes, you know, dirty concrete floors, workers in flip-flops and, you know, open-toed shoes, tables with rust on them. It's not a good scene.
And as an employee, were you responsible for the work that was happening offsite, or was that something that was sort of outside of your jurisdiction?
No, I was responsible for it. I was under a lot of pressure to get another one of these peeling sheds, you know, up and running so that Choice can get product out the door to the U.S.
Wow. And I know that in some of the other dealings that you had concerns about the use of antibiotics with some of these shrimp. Can you tell us about the use of antibiotics, why they're being used, and what, I guess, dangers they have?
So the antibiotics are being used by the shrimp farmers as a way to keep their stocks high and their costs low. The issue with them comes that they're banned by the FDA. We can't import product to the U.S. That contains any of these antibiotics. The FDA lists them as, you know, one of the issues is that they're carcinogenic.
Wow. So they're using these antibiotics, and I saw in some of the, you know, information that the company had asked you not to reference antibiotics in internal company exchanges, and that you had to use a code word, which, let me get this straight. I think the word was Oscar. Is that correct?
Yes. It was Oscar. I guess for the sake of, you know, if anybody else was looking at any records, Oscar could mean whatever you want it to mean.
Right.
But if you have in your records, hey, antibiotic positive, that might raise a few red flags.
For sure. And I also saw that the FDA only checks about 1% of all of the imported shrimp that are coming into the United States, whereas in the EU, more than about 50% of the shrimp are checked. So knowing that, then I guess the higher ups at your company can feel pretty safe that, you know, even if they ship shrimp that are testing positive for antibiotics, they're not truly going to get caught.
Correct. So even with that, you know, 1% being tested that comes into the U.S., it's not like there's an entire container load of antibiotic positive shrimp coming through. Even out of a 33,000 pound container load, there might be 2,000-4,000 pounds on that container that's tainted. So your odds are even lower of it being detected.
Okay. Yeah. So that makes sense. So were there any other, I guess, concerns with the shrimp, or was antibiotics really the big thing that was coming back positive when they were being tested before being shipped?
So antibiotics were the big illegal thing that was happening with shipping it to the US. The other food safety concerns, you know, really came out of those peeling sheds. You know, because hygiene really doesn't exist there. You know, your typical industry good manufacturing practices don't really exist over there. So the likelihood of products being contaminated, you know, things like E. coli or Salmonella, I mean, increase exponentially.
So I wanted to also touch on the Global Seafood Alliance. And then within that Global Seafood Alliance, there is a subset, I believe, called Best Aquaculture Practices Certification, which you all had, I take. I guess, how are you able to keep that certification if you're doing off-site peeling and sourcing shrimp from farms that weren't, I guess, under the company's jurisdiction?
So they're able to maintain the certification because those off-site peeling sheds, I mean, if they don't know about them, they can't audit them.
Right.
And as far as the antibiotic positive product, again, if you show them a different set of paperwork, then they don't know about it.
Wow. And then I did see that, again, that some of these ponds, right, were not on the radar either, where the shrimp were being grown. Is that correct?
Correct. There are, you know, small unregistered farms where for audit purposes, there's, you know, a set of records that says, hey, we're buying from, you know, these farms that are already certified under the best aquaculture practices, and these are suppliers. And that's what's shown to the auditors. But the truth is, you know, we're buying from whoever's farm, you know, right down the road.
Right. Probably not certified, you know, definitely
no,
not just,
no.
Yeah. Somebody made a pond and started growing shrimp in it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like for some of the purchase invoices where you'd expect to see the, you know, the full business name of this certified farm that you're buying from, it'll literally say farmer and just have a first name.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So anything to make it as convoluted as possible so that it can't be traced.
Correct.
Okay. So tell me about human rights issues or anything that you may have noticed while you were there.
The first thing that really got my attention was a text in the middle of the night from a production manager who was on site telling me there was a female worker running through the compound trying to climb over a wall in the water treatment portion of the compound because security wouldn't let her leave the compound and her employment contractor wanted her to pay money to be able to leave.
Wow.
So there's the first red flag of any potential, you know, human rights issues. And then once I started kind of looking into it a little bit more, digging a little deeper, you know, you find that none of those migrant workers who live on site are free to come and go as they please. They have to be issued this gate pass from their employment contractors. They have to present it to the security guards in order to be let out. And then they all come with, you know, times where you need to be back by.
Wow. And so describe that, I guess, with the contractors. Are these, I guess, people that are also at the plant that then are overseeing a group of workers?
There are, you know, representatives from the contractor who are on site keeping track of the workers.
And then these migrant workers, where are they coming from?
A little bit north of Andhra Pradesh. The state is Orissa.
Okay. Okay. And I guess what kind of conditions are these people living in while they're working there?
Some of the, well, a, a pretty good number of the men don't even have a bed to sleep in. There's just a dirty, ripped mattress on the floor of some of these dorm rooms where that's what they get to sleep on. They don't get a pillow, a blanket, sheets. You just get this mattress. Wow. Women, it's common that they have to share a bed. So that if one's out working first shift, you know, the woman who works night shift gets to sleep in that bed then. And then once night shift rolls around, the day shift worker will be able to sleep in that bed. Very, very cramped living. There's about 150 more migrant workers than there are beds.
So, and you described speaking, well, let's talk about the audits then, because some of these conditions that you described certainly wouldn't pass an audit. And you had spoken with a HR rep while you were there. It sounds like they used some different practices then to get around audits in regards to working conditions. Tell us about that.
So there was a social audit done in 2022. And when that auditor came on site, a large portion of the migrant workers were shipped off site so that the auditor wouldn't, I mean, the way it would look is that, hey, we have this many beds, we have this many workers, you know, nothing to see here.
Wow.
And there are other instances where an auditor would be on site and that auditor would be told, hey, we don't have any local workers coming in and we only have 250 migrant workers living on site. And shortly after the auditor writes down that information and takes a tour of the facility, I mean, you could see plain as day, there's 700 people that he just walked past in the plant actually working, plus everybody that's living on site. And I guess that gives them no pause whatsoever. They don't raise an eyebrow. They just check the box, say, okay, thank you. Let's move on.
And it sounds like too, that you had taken steps to try and have improvements made around the plant. What sort of feedback did you get when you would ask your superiors, hey, can we get more beds or what, you know, can we make more improvements?
So there was an instance in December, where I finally got looped into an email about having workers sleeping on the floor. You know, can we get more beds for them? And I didn't get looped into that email until about a week. Yeah, it was a week after the original request was sent. So even after, you know, HR and employee welfare sends an email to get beds for these workers, nobody responded to anything until I finally got looped in and said, please tell me they haven't been sleeping on a floor for over a week now. Like, this needs to be fixed.
Right. And were there other things that you wanted to see changed at the plant?
Yeah, the minimum wages, or, you know, wages in general, there was a point where I was renegotiating the wages for the workers, you know, with their contractors. And I proposed an increase to 400 rupees per day. They were making 350 at the time. Shortly after I proposed that increase, somebody from HR came over to me and said, hey, if you're going to increase it, you have to increase it to 450 because that's what the minimum wage is. So that kind of caught me a little off guard. You know, I was still under the impression at the time that ownership, you know, was doing the right thing. So I called one of the owners and said, hey, I'm not really sure how to approach your father about this, but I found out today that these workers aren't even being paid minimum wage. So he then calls his dad, who's the managing director of the company. He sends out an email, you know, I'm shocked. I can't believe this. You know, we always pay workers what they're supposed to be paid. And again, right after that, our VP of HR chimes in, includes the legal team in copy, and says, "Sir, we paid them exactly how you told us to pay them because we didn't plan on being at this factory that long."
Oh, wow.
And at this point, Choice had already been occupying that factory for about 2 years.
Wow. Okay. So, wow. And then, you know, as you kind of follow the progression of the things that you went through, it sort of reached this point where, or led up to an audit by Aldi, a grocery store chain, that is all over the United States now and certainly in Europe. What were some of the things that, that Choice Canning was trying to do in order to pass this Aldi audit?
Basically hide a lot of the migrant workers who were living there. The plan was to make arrangements with their labor contractors to find somewhere offsite to ship them for those 2 days, and to cancel the local laborers, to just have them stay home. So again, it would look like there's only a couple hundred people living and working there.
Wow.
So, and also to go back through all of the employees' payroll records to, you know, manipulate them in a way that would show they were being paid what they were supposed to be paid.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So just fully do their best to cover up what's actually happening, in other words.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. While you were there, did you see anything that might give you concern about the impact that these shrimp processing plants and ponds are having on the environment?
I knew that there were some issues with the local village, you know, about smells and, you know, concerns about the where all the processed water was going. But for the most part, I wasn't involved too much with those happenings.
Right. Right. So you've had this career in the seafood industry, and you make this big leap to go over to India to manage this processing plant. What compelled you to do this, to gather all this information and to, you know, stick your neck out to say what's really going on? What brought you to that point?
It was, you know, this gradual buildup where every time I saw something, or every time, you know, this data or information came across my desk and I would ask about it, it was always, well, it was just a misunderstanding here, it was just a misunderstanding there. And everything just wound up being, you know, misunderstanding after misunderstanding. And eventually you realize it's not a misunderstanding. It's a pattern. Mm-hmm. It's a pattern of shipping an unsafe product to the U.S. It's a pattern of not treating your workers the way they're supposed to be treated. Not paying them what they're supposed to be paid, not even giving them a bed to sleep on. So it got to the point where this needed to come out. You know, I'm human rights are universal. And when, you know, the consumer spends their hard earned money on a good meal, they shouldn't have to wonder if it's safe.
Right. So, well, and that kind of leads into my next question, which is, what do you want folks, not just in the United States, but globally, to know about shrimp consumption and, you know, what's going on? I mean, what would you advise someone in your family that's thinking about purchasing shrimp at a local grocery store?
You know what? I would advise them to look for something that's sourced locally or domestically, or, I mean, because, I mean, let's be honest, nobody's going to do a Google search after they pick up something off the shelves at the grocery store. Right.
Right.
It's just, you know, people need to be aware of what's out there, the hazards and the risks that are associated with it. And they, you know, we need to be able to make an informed decision about what we're putting on our dinner plates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You made a comment that you felt as if you were hired to give the appearance of legitimacy. Is that really kind of your takeaway from it?
The only thing I know for sure is that when I was hired, it was, you know, financially life-changing, right? I was being paid a very significant amount of money that, you know, after the 5 years the owner and I agreed to, it would have allowed my family and I to basically retire.
Wow.
I know it's far more than anybody else in the industry over there is making.
Wow. So it must have been, it's a hard decision then, right? Because you go into this thinking that, you know, you're going to be able to set yourself up and provide for your family. And then you get into the midst of it and you discover it's not what it appears to be.
Correct. And it was, you know, once I talked to my wife about it and I told her what I was seeing here, and, you know, she fully supported everything that I did after that. I mean, there's just too many other things that are far more important than my paycheck that needed to get out there.
Right. Well, look, Joshua, I applaud your courage. I can't imagine what it was like. And again, I mean, thank you so much for, you know, sharing your message with us and bringing to light what's really going on specifically at this company. And hopefully your story will help encourage other folks that are in other industries to do the same.
Thank you. And that, you know, thank you for actually paying attention to the story and helping to get this out there, because, you know, it's important that people know, you know, what's going on. And yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Joshua, with that, I will let you go. Thank you for joining us, and I wish you the best of luck going forward.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Joshua. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
I want to thank Joshua for joining me today and sharing with us his experience at the Choice Canning Shrimp Processing Plant in India. It takes a lot of courage to speak out against a large corporation like that, so I hope everybody can support Joshua in his quest to get the truth out. If you'd like to learn more, you can go to theoutlawocean.com. In speaking with Joshua, it also stuck out to me some of the need for companies like the Choice Canning Company to try to get these certifications, whether it's a certification from the Global Seafood Alliance with their best aquaculture practices, or another organization like the Marine Stewardship Council. There's lots of groups that are offering these certifications so that when consumers go out and buy some of these products, they see a blue tick or they see some sort of stamp that makes them feel like things are on the up and up, when the reality is more than likely that it's not. So I would encourage everyone listening to, you know, pay close attention to what's really going on and try to find out the truth. It takes courageous people like Joshua to shed the light on what's really going on for us to understand it in greater detail. I'm also looking forward to doing an episode that focuses on the life of the shrimp. I think that would be a really important message to get out there. So hopefully stay tuned for that. I will try to get that out soon, as it is topical right now. But yeah, I think we do need to do more for shrimp. These are sentient beings that deserve more protections, and they certainly deserve to be out in the ocean living their lives. I stated in the beginning that the Captain Paul Watson Foundation does not support the aquaculture of shrimp or any other organism for that matter. So I just wanted to reiterate that. The best thing that we can do for shrimp is to leave them to live their lives in the ocean. Lastly, I wanted to mention that this episode is brought to you by Litto Pineus Vaname. Thanks so much.
If the oceans die, we die.